At Mark's suggestion, the title of my talk is CMB Statistics the Right Way. Notice that right here is not meant to be in celebration of the choice of the Republicans' vice presidential nominee, but rather a discussion of correctness.
Cheney?
Yeah, it's Cheney. New York Times has a great title about how he had to go to his dad's cabinet to find his choice for VP. But rather, I went with this title because I figured it would serve two purposes. One, to get people awake to this point in the afternoon is useful. Although given the way talks have been going, probably much more dangerous. I should have slipped a sedative into the coffee instead. And the second, because it'll set out at the outset that I'm a hypocrite, and therefore no one can show that later by finding some mistake in these equations. And that is because when you look at the notes I've given you, I actually would like to set the ground rule that this is a ridiculous statement. There is, in fact, no right way to do statistics. No, no, not at all. A very clever one. There are, however,
the Bayesians would claim there is a right.
Yeah, I'm sure they would, but they're wrong. There are better and worse approaches. There are different approaches. There definitely are wrong ways, and that is if you use a statistic that tells you something, but claim it is telling you something else, that's an error. And I'm actually going to point out along the way today a couple of times in the recent literature where this has been done, and it actually makes a difference in cosmological parameters sometimes. So those are the papers to be most suspicious of. Remember that. What? That should be sigma.
Okay.
Good. First typo. Credit goes to Martin. That was just an example equation anyway. Okay, so remember Bayesian and frequentist approaches are completely different. Frequentist approach, the way I think about it, is essentially the way we all learned the scientific method way back when. You've got a bunch of different hypotheses. You'd like to know which of them can be falsified at some confidence level versus the data. And so you basically ask, given a particular hypothesis, what are the odds that my data would disagree with that hypothesis as much as they do or more? So if there's a 32% chance you'd get as bad of a fit, then you say that model's ruled out at 68% confidence. There's a 5% chance you get as bad of a fit, you say that model's ruled out at 95% confidence. And you go model by model and make statements. When you're done, at some confidence level, you're left with some set of your hypotheses, and you don't try to decide which of those is right and what the truth is. You look for a better experiment and better data to decide about amongst them later on. The Bayesian question's a little bit different. It's more attractive to most of us, I think. Not that that means it's better. It's certainly more attractive to the media, and that is to say, all right, given what we knew before, plus this new data set we have in hand, what's our best guess at the truth? And what set of models seems to have a 68% chance of encompassing the truth? And that would be called a credible region. And that's what you get left with at the end of a Bayesian analysis. And so I know you guys have all seen Bayes' theorem. Starts from the probability statement, which would be true for any two variables. And then what we're really interested now, if we're Bayesians, given the data, what's the probability of the theory being right? And there's some P of D down here, which you can actually normalize with, but you always end up doing a relative analysis in this case, so actually what counts is that proportionality. This piece is the likelihood function. And that would be calculated whether you're frequentist or Bayesian. The difference is whether you multiply by a prior distribution of theories and ask the question about the theory at the end of the day, or if you're just using this piece of information model by model to check. And so you'll see along the way today, most of the time, you can actually talk in terms of CMB data about this thing and then go on to either do a frequentist or a Bayesian analysis. All right, so in CMB data, what are we used to talking about? We're used to talking about a set of data that we believe is the combination of some actual sky signal and some noise. We're used to forming covariance matrices of these things. If we had noise that's independent pixel to pixel, the matrix would be a diagonal, but it's typically not. So we do this. We'll later on for the theory form a similar matrix. Now, the distribution of noise in your instrument is not going to be described only by this. It's typically also going to be described by the statement that the expectation value of the noise is zero in each pixel. some kind of Gaussianly distributed noise. And because we subtract off 2.73 Kelvin, or develop observing strategies that aren't sensitive to it, expectation of sky temperatures is also generally zero. Now, what I've written down for you here is assumption one, is that this is sufficient to completely describe the noise in the instrument. That is, that the noise is a multivariate Gaussian. If something's a multivariate Gaussian, it's described only by the mean and this covariance matrix and no higher order moments. That doesn't have to be true, and one of the things you always want to do in a CMB experiment is check if that's true. But even for these instruments with correlated noise, like Boomerang and Maxima, it does appear so far that the noise is consistent enough with Gaussian that working on from here is reasonable. And of course, for our theories of the CMB sky, the signal is supposed to be purely Gaussian, although we have statistics developed like the bispectrum and temperature distributions that you can check with. Now, please.
What are the tests that you're referring to when the noise is Gaussian or non-Gaussian?
It's actually not. Okay, I haven't tested the time stream, but you have to go to the time stream to estimate the correlation of the noise in these balloon experiments. And you can, when you reconstruct your noise pixel by pixel, you can look to see if the distributions of noise in a given pixel as a function of time appear to be a Gaussian distribution. There's actually a statistical subtlety that we were discussing about a week ago that actually only is a statement that your marginal distribution of the noise is Gaussian. And you could have a contrived distribution of noise where the marginal distributions pixel by pixel were Gaussian, but the actual full distribution was not. No one seems to be able to come up with a reason why that should happen in real life. So, in general, if the marginal distribution appears Gaussian, that's considered good enough proof. It's not a subtle thing to prove in detail. That's right. So, in fact, the most likely, I talked to John Rule about this for a while, and we sort of decided that the most likely thing to make this be an unfair assumption is cosmic ray hits, something that gives you a skewness. And they subtract cosmic rays, of course, in the time stream, but if you have a glancing cosmic ray, you may not notice it, you may not detect it and not subtract it. So there'll be some level of skewness. And so what actually needs to be done before you believe an analysis from an instrumental team, hopefully it's some other team themselves, is to actually go in and check just how off this assumption is. It's not trivial to decide how you evaluate how much error that causes, right? Because all the nice ways we have of evaluating the likelihood function depend on it being somewhat Gaussian. But you could mock up a model for what the chances are of getting a different noise distribution and see what happens. And those kind of checks need to be done. I think certainly with this most recent ration of experiments, they haven't been done enough yet, partly because they wanted to get the quick cosmology results out, and partly because they're pretty difficult. So these are the things you can be skeptical about if you want to be skeptical. Let's imagine a toy model for a second. I know most of you guys have seen this stuff before, but just to set the stage, let's imagine that a theory actually specifies all of the sky values at every pixel. This is not a nice Gaussian isotropic CMB theory. It's like a God-given theory. Our theory tells us exactly what the sky would be at every pixel. But of course, we still have instrument noise, so we can test the likelihood of that kind of a theory. And that would say the likelihood of the data given that theory . What I'm going to do mostly is draw proportionalities for you. And of course, the way this normalizes is yes, good. No, absolutely. So you subtract off the known sky signal for the theory. You're actually just asking, what you're really asking is this. Right, which makes sense. This is the covariance of the noise. What you've done is just said the noise is equal to your data minus the known sky as a function of the theory. Now, this is not the type of example we're used to. But it shows you exactly. This is nice and constrained. It's a single Gaussian distribution of noise. Your theory specified everything. You tested the likelihood. You can imagine basically the opposite simple example, right? What if you had a noiseless experiment, which is really a great thing to think about, then you'd ask, what's the chance of the data given the theory? And now you have no problem from the noise, but you have correlations in the signal. Where the inferred signal here is just is actually just the data. You can imagine using the data for that. Now that's noiseless case. And so this would be telling you each theory predicts this CS matrix, so you can evaluate the likelihood of any of the data given any particular theory. What we typically do, of course, is put these two together. We don't have a fully specified sky, we just have a theory that gives you a probability distribution of the data from the C sub L's, and you don't have a noiseless instrument. And so we like to go ahead and say, and so now I'm sort of working through an example like working down towards equation 10 in the notes I handed out. We like to say that the instrument noise is uncorrelated with fluctuations on the sky. And if that's true, we can check to see if we understand how things are going to behave as the covariance matrix of the data. So the data is just some signal plus noise. They're assumed uncorrelated. Then everything's good. The cross terms don't matter because they each have expectation value 0. And we're left with the statement that the covariance matrix of the data is just the covariance matrix of the signal plus the covariance matrix of the noise. Since each of these is a multivariate, since both the noise and the signal are multivariate Gaussian distributions, their sum will be a multivariate Gaussian distribution. And you can check that because just as the cross terms went away here, if you now start to calculate 3 and 4 point and higher order correlation functions, they will just depend upon these, and because each of these pieces is a Gaussian, you'll be able to show that all the higher moments are unimportant. However, this assumption that the signal and the noise are uncorrelated, that we always make blindly in CMB analysis, is not generically right. In fact, in many areas of astrophysics, it would be completely wrong. For instance, when we do optical observations of high redshift galaxies, a significant source of noise is the Poisson counts from the object itself. This is especially true in really high energy astrophysics, where you have very few X-ray photons coming from an X-ray source, and the Poissonian noise in the number of X-ray photons is a significant source of the noise. We live in this happy regime with the CMB, where there's so many photons coming in that Poissonian noise is unimportant. And I'd actually never thought about that before, but of course in optical observing we worry about this all the time. And you can actually do a nice little back of envelope just to see what would happen. And it turns out that there's two reasons why for the CMB this Poissonian noise is really unimportant. First reason, of course, is that delta T over T is about 10 to the minus 5. So almost all the photons you have coming at you at any point in time are basically from the 2.73 Kelvin, and very few are tracing the temperature fluctuations. It's precisely why it's hard to measure the temperature fluctuations. So your Poissonian fluctuation is going to go like the square root of the number of photons coming in, but that's going to be uncorrelated to incredible precision with the actual temperature fluctuations, because all of that Poissonian is going to be from the temperature part. So that would not be a big problem. However, it is a source of noise in your detector. And having sat through a lot of experimental talks, I was not aware of whether or not that source of noise is a dominant part or an irrelevant part of the instrumental noise. And you can do the back of envelope really quickly in the sense that the number of photons you're going to get is about the 400 CMB photons per cubic centimeter times the speed of light. That ends up being about 10 to the 13 photons per centimeter squared per second. And so it's pretty small. So the Poissonian fluctuations in that coming into your detector are going to go like the square root of it. What you really care about is what fractional fluctuation this is going to cause. Is it comparable to 10 to the minus 5? And the answer here is that it's going to be about 3 times 10 to the minus 7 times the area of your detector in square centimeters times the time of your observation in seconds. So you'd have to build a really small detector and look for a really short time before this turned out to be the dominant source of detector noise. However, when I asked John Rule about this, he says that especially for some of the very cutting-edge detectors, this is a serious source of the noise. And there's something called the NET limit, blip limit, where this actually becomes the dominant source of noise. So
I don't believe your statement.
OK, go ahead.
You're talking about the distribution of the noise, not whether it's correlated with the signal. They're different statements.
OK, which statement don't you believe?
If your Poisson fluctuations were correlated with the signal.
Right. Then you'd have a problem. In the CMB, you're not...
It doesn't matter how many photons you have, as long as the noise is not correlated with the signal.
Well, no, there's two things. I'm sorry. You must have missed something I said.
If most of the photons are coming from the signal, then...
Right, in this case...
Then you get Poisson. I mean, you get self-noise.
Right. You don't in this case.
You get really bright rings.
Right, absolutely.
We're not here, so...
That's not valid in this regime.
Yeah.
No, so the assumption that the signal and the noise are uncorrelated is definitely valid because delta T over T is so small that you'd never correlate.
Not because. I mean, it's just valid regardless of the distribution of the noise. Within the textbook on statistical inference, it's a definition of what you mean by noise.
Well, okay, in optical astronomy, we use a different definition of noise then. Because a dominant source of our, in certain regimes, a dominant source of our noise comes from the Poissonian fluctuations in the signal itself.
Yeah, but that's in the signal.
All right, this doesn't matter.
Oh.
The fluctuations are not correlated with the signal.
You're right, their amplitude is. Their amplitude, okay, this is, okay, you're right.
Better not matter on the signal.
All right, that is a fair statement. So what Martin's saying, and you're right, I've misstated this, is that your Poissonian fluctuations are going to go up or down. So even if your signal was a main source of your noise, you still wouldn't know whether it was going to go up or down, so it would be uncorrelated. But the sort of local error bar, the size of those fluctuations, depends on the amplitude of the signal. That's absolutely fair. Okay, so... wanted to give this aside because this is an issue I hadn't thought about before. I thought it was kind of interesting.
I think for the Planck belongings, the blip limit is very important.
It may well be. I don't know enough about detector design to tell you how big that area is, but...
And the time constant.
Right. So when we put everything together, got signal plus noise. Yeah, you do beat the noise down. But it might be that each piece of the noise is dominated by the photon counts, not by electronic noise. So really the way I view this is, if you want to do the likelihood function of the data given the theory, it's an integral over all possible realizations of signal, all possible realizations of noise, probability of getting that sky for a given theory, probability of getting that noise, which is not a function of the theory, and then this delta function that you had to actually get the observed data. And when you sort of take care of the delta function, you end up with a convolution, which is now you really have only one integral. You can choose what you want to do, doesn't make any difference. It looks like that. And what's beautiful is, even though this is all sorts of statistics, the convolution theorem for Fourier transforms applies. Statisticians like to call that the usage of characteristic functions, but it ends up being the same thing. And because each of these things, being independent, is Gaussian, you really do end up with a distribution that's Gaussian. And so, exactly because the signal and the noise were uncorrelated before, they're independent here, and you end up with the, well, I'm not going to worry about normalization since they're sitting in front of you. But of course, there's a determinant down there. And so the likelihood function does turn out to be Gaussian. And, you know, all the discussions of we need to get the exact likelihood function that requires inverting this matrix, which is not sparse in the way we'd like it to be. This is typically an n-cubed operation. We'd like to know how to approximate that, make it n squared log n, because for the size instruments Map and Planck, all these things are saying we know the exact likelihood because it's Gaussian, and so we'd really like to do the best job we can of getting this. The funny thing is, from here on...
Can I just repeat what you said about inverting?
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, you want me to repeat what I said? Yeah, so... Well, typically, the inversion is n cubed, right? And you'd like to get it to go as n squared log n, which is the best you can do under certain assumptions about the shape of the... Right, but I mean, you can sort of imagine, you'd like it to go to 1, but you can imagine approximations that people have worked out that'll make you go n squared log n, and there are some approximative algorithms. But what's interesting is in real world experiments, you never actually end up with this Gaussian shape for the likelihood function anyway. And that's sort of the next level of realism that I'm adding here when we talk about calibration and beam uncertainties. And I think for the sake of time, I'll just show the example of calibration uncertainty. What happens is, really, things are a function of more than just this. Yeah?
I don't believe equations well.
The first part or the second part?
So noise depends on your calibration uncertainty, too.
Not when you get it from your instrument. The noise is being measured in units of nominal microkelvin, and the theory makes predictions in real microkelvin. Calibration uncertainty only affects one at a time. Yeah. Now imagine that I'm wrong. What I'm calling a microkelvin is actually a kelvin, right? But I'm measuring plus or minus 5 of those units as the distribution of my noise. Now, if I calculated my noise ahead of time from sort of theoretical electronics, I might have a problem like that. But because the noise is always determined from the instrument empirically, the noise is determined in post-calibration units.
So are you assuming that when you're doing the noise estimate, the signal is totally subdominant or something? You have to simultaneously estimate the signal and noise.
Well, so if you want to be really fancy about it, in fact, there will be an uncertainty in your estimate of the noise. That's going to be sort of like the next order. You're going to have to integrate this likelihood over all function errors in the noise, obeying some predicted distribution of your error in estimating the noise.
In general, you have many, many integrations or individual points where the signal has not changed. And that makes it essentially orthogonal to determine the noise from determining the signal.
But, I mean, this is definitely an approximation, but this is the way it's done. Yeah, the best paper I know on this, although it's really heaffy to read through, is the Ferrara-Jaffe paper on how they're getting the noise covariance matrix from the time stream of maxima. And you basically come up with a regime in which the signal is quite subdominant, and then you estimate the noise from that using an algorithm.
I mean, MATCAP does it iteratively, doesn't it? It first assumes that there's no signal, but then estimates the signal, and then recalculates the noise in the base sequence.
So the important piece about this equation 12 that I think bothered Martin at first, but it's really right, is that your calibration uncertainty only affects part of this matrix up here. So you end up with C squared times the signal matrix and then the noise. And, I mean, you could define C differently and end up having the C on this part and not this one. That's not important. Well, what happens is now you're going to have a situation where your likelihood is a function of your calibration parameter and in a way that doesn't make it truly Gaussian anymore. And let's be good and actually write that down.
Well, in general, we just subsume the calibration uncertainty into what is usually an unknown amplitude in the model.
So you can get out of this problem in exactly that way. If you decide that the amplitude of the model is a nuisance parameter, and that the calibration is a nuisance parameter, the second statement being almost always your attitude, then they're completely degenerate, and that's fine. And you're now willing to sort of estimate some CA as the amplitude of the model. This fails for the next example, which is beam uncertainty. Because when you start adjusting your beam, the predictions of your theory actually now change in shape. And that's no longer orthogonal to the other parameters that you care about. Another thing to say is that it isn't so easy as always doing this. For a single instrument analysis, you can basically do this. What's the difference between calibration change and amplitude change in the model? When you're comparing two different instruments, imagine for a second that one's actually perfectly calibrated. Now you actually want to know how the amplitude of one versus the other is telling you about the theory shape. Imagine they're measuring different L's for a second. And it's not enough to just say, I don't care about the amplitude of the theory here, but I do care about the amplitude of the theory here. You don't have that freedom. So whenever you're going to compare multiple instruments...
But you do have to be careful on that beam uncertainty. Usually the beam uncertainty is really just a calibration offset. The changes to the beam are not...
a function of L.
Well, they're not really changing the size of the beam as far as how it looks on the sky. I mean, this is true in some cases and not in others.
So the examples I'm thinking of are Boomerang and Maxima, because they're sort of the data sets everyone's most excited about nowadays. And in that case, my impression is that really is changing the size of the beam on the sky.
Well, you're
talking about a 10 to 20% difference at high L.
A little bit different than where the main beam, the shapes of the main beam in detail.
Okay. There certainly are subtleties.
How it affects the signal.
That's correct. But, I mean, would you maintain that that beam uncertainty is degenerate with some other parameter of the model?
I would maintain that it's almost all an amplitude offset.
I mean,
that it's rather small in affecting how it sees the sky, other than an amplitude.
So when Boomerang plots their beam uncertainty, are they misrepresenting it?
Well, it's on the range of scales, or?
Yeah.
That's good. Like if you're focusing on a certain range of scales, in that range, all the beam uncertainty
Yes.
would be up and down.
Right, I mean, the Boomerang guys have been nice enough to sort of plot up as a function of L what their beam uncertainty does, and it's a much bigger error bar at high L than at low L. So I think in some sense...
I'm not saying it's not a function of L.
Right.
I'm saying that's more or less just an amplitude offset.
Well, as we're moving towards instruments with wide coverage in L, that assumption's becoming less and less accurate. Sure it is.
That's a detail.
Okay, Steve, I don't understand how you can... I mean, yes, there's one level at which the beam... the beam uncertainty is some combination of an amplitude uncertainty with a shape uncertainty. The wider range in L you have, the bigger that shape uncertainty factor becomes.
You're saying nothing new here, so this is continuing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't claim that this was anything new. So what happens is, if you're only doing one instrument... you can still have a multivariate Gaussian likelihood function by just assuming the calibration into your theory. But if you're comparing multiple instruments, that's not possible anymore. And if you have a beam uncertainty, it's not possible anymore. So we're already forced into the regime where we have to somehow approximate the likelihood. Now, you can do this full numerical integral. Remember, there's going to be a term in here as well for how far off the calibration uncertainty you're considering is from what you think it should be, which is a calibration factor of 1. And you can even imagine sort of doing a chi-squared statistic with this exponent. That's what in here identified as equation 13. Notice that that doesn't obey a chi-squared distribution. So it's almost cruel to call it chi-squared sub c. You'd have to actually go ahead and simulate the distribution of that statistic in order to use it as a misfit statistic. But that is something that a frequentist might well do. So we've arrived here at the point where things are already complicated enough, and this is the way the experiments look already, that you don't have a nice multivariate Gaussian likelihood. And in fact, the way they really do things is to sort of approximate this likelihood function for a given theory, choose a range of calibration parameters, choose a range of beam parameters, and now sort of do a numerical integral over that approximated likelihood function. There's no longer any kind of great analytical solution. So although this matrix inversion is still a necessary part, you're doing it many more times. And at this point, you're really willing to tolerate more approximations because you're going to do an approximation anyway. And there's, I think, a lot of room for work in just how much approximation you could do at this step since you're already approximating at the integral step later on. But nothing is exact in the way that it used to be advertised anymore. Let me move on to a correlated but different issue, and that is the issue of... That's absolutely true. In fact, you kind of know it has to be a bit log normal or something, because your calibration uncertainty, your calibration factor can't go down to zero, as you hope. So, and you could approximate as a Gaussian in log C something like this. Generally, it doesn't, remember, it doesn't have to be Gaussian as this. Whatever P of C really is what you should put in here. And a lot of the observers will tell you that it's more like a top hat. I'm sorry, there's an integral over C now. Like in equation 12. So let's talk about marginalization. Something like the calibration uncertainty can be a nuisance parameter. Something like the beam uncertainty can be a nuisance parameter. It's also now fashionable to talk about a set of cosmological parameters as nuisance parameters. We really want to know about omega matter, comma omega lambda, not omega b, Hubble constant, all these guys, even though we promised in a bunch of papers that we were going to measure all of them to 3%. Now we're deciding that with the current data, let's just concentrate on a couple and treat the other cosmological parameters as nuisance parameters. There's really two kinds of nuisance parameters then. Beam and calibration uncertainty that you think you know the distribution of, sort of estimated from your instrument, and then cosmological nuisance parameters that you have to be Bayesian and choose a prior for, or you have to be frequentist and just say, well, they're nuisance, so I'll take the best fit value. That last thing would be called maximization. So we want to talk about what's probability of the data given the theory as sort of an integral over all possible values of a nuisance parameter. This would be a Bayesian way to do things. Or if U has a known distribution, I would maintain that this is also frequentist ways to do things. If you know the distribution of U, this is simply a true statement. If you don't know the distribution of U and you're Bayesian, then this becomes a prior. Well, the idea of maximization, so this would really be marginalization. The idea of maximization is to just say, well, let's see. For every theory, there's some best fit value, U star, of this nuisance parameter. And that is definitely a function of the theory. If you pick a different value of omega matter, omega lambda, there'll be a different best fit value of omega b comma Hubble constant, or a different best fit value of the beam uncertainty. When you do this, what's happening in a lot of analyses now, and in this case I'm referring particularly to some of what Tegmark and Zeldarraga have done to be able to handle this 11-dimensional parameter space they work in, to what Melchiori did with the boomerang test flight data, and that actually worked its way into the Nature paper analysis for boomerang, and also what they're doing in the analysis of maxima, is to do this marginalization over an n-dimensional parameter space is computationally intensive, but it's faster to just sort of search and find the best fit value of these nuisance cosmological parameters. So even though they're officially in the context of a Bayesian analysis, they're doing this maximization over what they call nuisance parameters. Now, it is very easy to show that what this corresponds to doing is assuming a delta function prior in U. And what would that mean? Well, you marginalize, then sure enough, that equals that is precisely what they are doing. No question. Now, there are
not very doesn't call it higher means excuse me. You start using the
it's messy. I would call it retroactively assuming a delta function prior. That's the best phrase I've come up with to explain what they're doing in these papers. It's a retroactive prior. Now, they defend themselves. I would call this the apologist view. By saying that if the likelihood function is really Gaussian in this nuisance parameter, because after all, we love for everything to be Gaussian, it's always a nice approximation around the peak. Well, not always, but often. Then, sure enough, and I've sort of showed you this in this equation 18, the same thing happens. So, and now that might seem like a miracle, but it's really happening because the Gaussian is symmetrical. Gaussian in this parameter is different than saying it's a multivariate Gaussian in all the parameters, after all. Gaussian in this parameter means that the integral decouples, and you're now just integrating over this distribution of U, or U minus U star. So in that perfect limit, they don't have to retroactively assume a delta function prior. They still get this answer out of marginalization. But of course, that requires that this nuisance parameter U be completely uncoupled, be orthogonal, with all the other parameters that you're going to work on. So that would be the statement that the curvature of the likelihood function is zero for all theoretical parameters other than your nuisance parameter. That's not generally true. The other thing to say is if you're doing a Bayesian analysis, which these papers claim to be doing, then you should be varying the prior. And if this likelihood function is actually magically Gaussian in your nuisance parameter, then if you multiply by a uniform prior, the thing you integrate over will still be Gaussian, but any other prior won't be. And so this nice approximation can only be approximate. And so I don't really understand why they're doing this. And this is not only of interest as sort of a statistical issue, but it's quite relevant for the estimation of cosmological parameters. The results that Boomerang gets, I was talking to Dmitry Prigozhin about this yesterday, depend in a significant way on whether they maximize or marginalize.
The reason why it's hard to integrate.
Oh, absolutely. Maximization saves you time. But it's not a Bayesian way to do things. And so if you want to do a frequentist approach, you get to maximize anyway. It saves you a lot of time. In the context of a Bayesian analysis, I cannot figure out what it means, except for retroactively assuming a delta function prior, or assuming that your likelihood function is completely Gaussian in your nuisance parameter, even though you can test from the likelihood function that that's not true. So they do a fit to omega total. Let's see, there's a magic value of 1. And so the sort of maximization way has a best fit at like 1.05. And the marginalization way has a best fit at like 1.10. And the value here is like 0.8 of the maximum. And here it's actually 0.2. Imagine this is a log plot. So there's a significant difference between these two data analysis methods. Now, significant is a subtle term. After all, the level of discretization in the database of parameters that they're considering is 0.05 in omega total. So you have to ask, is it actually something you could expect to distinguish between 1.05 and 1.10 very well? The answer is just barely. So probably you shouldn't make too much of this. But for instance, in the Nature paper, they had a best fit omega total of essentially 1.0 plus or minus 0.05. Now in Lang et al. Analyses, it's moved up to 1.1 plus or minus 0.05. So you're talking about effects that, albeit probably we shouldn't be too concerned about, do seem to make a difference versus the error bars. At some level, that's just a statement of systematic uncertainty. What it really is because I would maintain to you that what they're doing in this method is just flawed. It really is a statement that that flaw makes a difference. It's not just sort of statistically not kosher, but it actually makes a difference and makes a systematic bias in your estimation of parameters. And I mean, if you think about it, in this estimate of omega total, they're going through and they have several nuisance parameters, scalar spectral index, omega b, and h, all of which get maximized instead of marginalized. So you can imagine that that's going to make a difference in models. And it does. I think there's one other thing that you'll find in the literature, and this is a little more restricted to the Melchiori et al. Paper, to sometimes usage in the Lang et al. Analysis. And I'm still trying to figure out if it's in what Maxima did in the Balbi et al. Paper. You can't tell for sure. I guess one of the overall comments and problems is that because everyone's publishing multiple letters per instrument and no long papers, you really can never figure out what they did in their data analysis at any step of the way. And that's unfortunate. And you know, everyone I talk to agrees it's unfortunate, but that doesn't make them write long papers. So it's very hard to tell.
A micro dot at the end, like last period in the acknowledgement.
I'll get my magnifying glass out and look. So I just sort of listed down here, there's a particular thing that they do as part of the Bayesian analysis in Melchiori and sometimes in Lang et al., which is when they want to decide, now they've got their likelihood function, they'd like to set a 68% confidence region. They sort of say, well, I bet this thing's close to Gaussian around the peak. I can even look at it, and it is close to Gaussian around the peak. So 68% of my area should be contained down to the value of e to the minus 1/2 times the likelihood maximum. And if it were precisely Gaussian, that would be undoubtedly true. But for anything that's not Gaussian, it's not precisely true. And what's funny is they've already calculated the likelihood function, so they really could just keep going down, sort of drop a threshold, and wait until they get 68% of the area. But instead, they choose to make this approximation. When you do that, there's a few problems. I've listed them here. One is that you're depending more sensibly on exactly the L max within your database, which is going to fluctuate more than some kind of an integral will. Also, if you have n parameters you're fitting, they may not use up exactly n degrees of freedom. So if that's true, you can immediately expect that you won't have a Gaussian shape in the likelihood of those n parameters. And then the third thing is you're always supposed to be preparing the prior in a Bayesian analysis, unless you actually knew what the prior was, in which case I think you'd be God. And therefore, you know that even if this approximation is right for some likelihood function of the data given the theory, as you vary the prior, you're going to be morphing the shape around. And inevitably, that's going to make a difference.
Well, the main reason, at least that some of us use just a fixed likelihood cutoff, is because if you're trying to integrate under it, you have to decide what the measure is. In other words, why should you integrate?
Absolutely.
And not omega to the 0.6.
Absolutely. And that directly corresponds to the issue of a prior. There's two ways to view the prior, right? You can either view what you integrate under is being likelihood of data given theory times prior on the theory, and integrate under this. Or you can think of yourself as always integrating under likelihood of data given theory, but changing the metric to be non-Euclidean based upon what your prior is. They're going to be exactly the same thing. And that's what Steve's talking about here in terms of changing the measure. And the answer is, because we don't know what the prior is, we don't know exactly what that measure should be.
It turns out you can actually, and that's something I played with for the original ring data, is you can, what you want is a prior that doesn't depend on the parameterization, whether you use some function of t, for example, t is some variable. Turns out the Fisher information matrix.
You can get sort of this.
It's a good measure in the sense that what it does is it flattens out where your experiment has no information about the parameter you're talking about.
This is sort of a maximum entropy prior. It's the
I haven't quite figured out what it is as far as a prior, but it has the right transformation property.
So that's
I haven't looked at it again since I did that and decided it made no difference for the data that I had.
Yeah, I mean, if you vary priors over what you consider to be a reasonable range and it makes no difference, that's good news. Reasonable is a subtle thing, but your innate sense that's not bad. Leecher? Absolutely.
The likelihood is very well peaked.
Right.
Then you can do everything you want to the prior, and the result is not going to change that much. So you just
have to Right. If the likelihood's really well peaked.
You're interested in.
But it also depends what you consider reasonable, right? If for some reason I really think that this kind of prior is reasonable, that likelihood might not have been well enough peaked.
So
but
what do you mean with varying the prior?
Well, because you don't know what the prior actually is.
You wouldn't say that. You do know what the prior is. You get
what's
the prior.
That's what the
prior is.
Well,
the
prior is what you know.
Well, no. I mean, for example, you could choose a Gaussian. Do you choose a Gaussian in omega or omega squared?
If you don't know, you should choose a flat prior.
Yeah.
Flat's subjective.
Yeah, in what variables? It's not a variable.
Well, okay, if you want to make it independent of the variables, there are ways of.
Yeah, but if you do things like that, we got into problems in the old days where we had upper limits. And you would argue that to make it invariant under multiplications, you should use a 1 over the amplitude prior. That gives you completely bogus results. Because it's heavily weighting the low amplitudes at which your experiment has no information. Yet it's saying that you have high prior discrimination in those models. So that's why I say there are ways, but you have to be a little careful. And it ends up, I think the robust way is using the Fisher information matrix, because that transforms the right way under transformations of the variable.
After all, your experiment doesn't care whether I'm talking omega or omega squared.
Look, in a sense, Ben's right. You get to choose the prior, and then you report your results as the results given this prior.
Yeah.
You can certainly always do that. But
that's effectively what you do.
I mean, if you want to know if your estimate of 68% chance of having found the true theory is dependent on your prior or not, you need to vary it.
Well, the Fisher matrix is a prior as well, because it doesn't include the data, only the experiment and the noise.
We basically mean partial squared likelihood, partial alpha, partial.
Yeah.
Well, right. So how do you turn that into a prior?
Can
you
give a talk about this?
Yeah.
It's in my notes somewhere. It's because you're asking the expectation. It's not d squared. Well, it's not the likelihood of the data that's expected.
Expected, not
that's a green card either.
Yeah.
It's the thing that everybody plays with currently.
But that's a matrix. It's still a matrix. It's still a matrix.
Yeah.
When you take the number, then it's
something like that. I'd have to sit down and figure it out.
That's true. This theory. So, actually, I wanted to comment on one more thing, and then.
What you do, sir?
Anyway.
Okay. So the one more thing I was going to comment on is exactly this issue of setting this credible region at the end. You want the volume under the likelihood surface, now we're dealing in n dimensions, so it's an n plus one dimensional volume, to equal 68% or 95% or whatever number you're after. And if it's really Gaussian, just about everything you can think of doing will give you the same answer. You can imagine starting at the end and sort of integrating up to get 16% of the area here, starting at the other end, getting 16% here. Now that's a 1D example. That doesn't work really well in a lot of dimensions, but you can start at the top and sort of move down, sort of moving the same rate in either direction to get 68%. You could now do that in multiple dimensions. You could just drop a threshold down until you get 68%. You could even imagine working from the mean for a Gaussian, they all agree. But when it's non-Gaussian, these will actually produce different results. For instance, and I'm actually going back to 1D here because it's easy to visualize, but you can imagine this happens in multiple dimensions. If you have multiple maxima, or multiple local maxima, then starting from the mode and sort of going until you get a certain percentage of the area and requiring that it be contiguous will do something like this, but dropping the threshold may well do something like that. It's not Gaussian. These will disagree. You have to decide what you think is the best. I would certainly advocate this last way. As always, there's not a right way or a wrong way. You just want to know what your statistic is doing. But the last way sort of picks out the set of theories, again, in the context of Bayesian analysis, which are the most likely ones and under which you get 68% of your volume. That does not require that the result is simply connected. And that seems good, because if there's multiple local maxima, you'd probably like to know that. But there's a choice of statistics here.
Highest probability density. It's well known in Bayesian.
It's the one that all of the textbooks
yes.
say you should use.
Yes.
Yeah. So maybe that's almost a right way. It's almost a consensus. It's hard to find in statistics.
It's in more than one
textbook. Oh.
Yeah, that's right. And then the other stuff I offered you guys here, you're already familiar with. The idea of data compression into band power estimates, and then sort of just a little summary of what Bon Jaffe and Knox, this offset log normal approximation, actually boils down to. And it's kind of a funny thing. It sort of says, if people are going to do a chi-squared analysis, what's the best variable we can give them to do the chi-squared in? Turns out to be this function of the log of CL plus a noise term. But by the time you're getting that complex, it may well be better motivated to just do a fuller approximation to the likelihood function. So it's not really clear that that's a great intermediate step, but it does have a well-posed origin. Any other questions? Sorry?
What do you mean by fuller approximation?
Well, they're finding the variable in which the curvature of the likelihood is constant, regardless of what turns out to be the best fit. But that doesn't mean it lacks higher order terms. They're not finding a variable in which the likelihood is actually Gaussian. They're just finding a variable in which the likelihood is Gaussian when you only do it a Taylor expansion to second order. So you can imagine including higher order terms. And well, it sort of, at first it sounds like that involves more levels of approximation. Because they've already shifted variables, you could basically come up with a higher order term that didn't shift variables that had basically as many calculations to do. And so it may well be better. And this is, I think, what Dick Baum was talking about at the conference when he says that they're actually going to put on the websites, hopefully, some discussion of what the likelihood function is. If you've completely calculated it, there's no reason to approximate it. You can just give it to people in a table. And compared to everything else we do, especially on band powers, that's not computationally that intensive to handle. It's not going to be exactly Gaussian, so you can't just do a chi-squared. But there are ways of doing likelihood analysis, either as a frequentist or a Bayesian, on the full likelihood function. Other questions? Okay, thanks.
So I think this was the last organized activity for the workshop. So thanks for coming up to the stage. See you at the next one. And I'll thank the organizers then. I should also make sure to thank Lars Bill.